Once upon a time, in a gloomy castle on a lonely hill where there were 13 clocks that wouldn't go, there lived a cold, aggressive Dizzy.
What?
And his niece? Her niece? The princess.
Guess!
Guess was warm in every wind and weather, but Diz was always cold.
Ice cold.
Her hands were as cold as her smile and almost as cold as her heart. She wore gloves when she was asleep, and she wore gloves when she was awake, which made it difficult for her to pick up pins or coins or the kernels of nuts, or to tear the wings from nightingales.
Might be too far.
She was 6'4" and 46, and even colder than they thought she was. One eye wore a velvet patch, the other glittered through a monocle, which made half her body seem closer to you than the other half.
Beware.
She had lost one eye when she was 12, for she was fond of peering into nests and lairs in search of birds and animals to maul. One afternoon, a mother shrike had mauled her first.
Ouch.
Her nights were spent in evil dreams, and her days were given to wicked schemes.
Welcome to Church Drunk.
A spirited conversation about faith, reason, and libations.
And apparently villains
and
today.
Villains and knights in shining armor, yeah. And everything else.
And princesses.
Yeah, and princesses, yes.
Wearing
and
special vestments.
Galaxies.
I mean dresses.
And 13 clocks.
Amen.
So, once again, as usual, before we get too deep into this, you should know that we tend to be cursy, heretical, blasphemous,
irreverent
individuals. If
Whatever.
That's not your style, then touche, elsewhere
yep.
you go.
Yep.
And we also are Catholic. You don't have to be. We hope that everybody is welcome here as we work through our Church Drunk summer reading list.
Getting to the loopy end.
And Diz, the question as always is, what are you drinking?
Well, my cold, cold hands
yes.
are cupping a warm, warm glass of blood red wine.
Ooh, look at you getting descriptive.
I am wordy today.
Yeah.
And how about you, good sir?
I also am drinking a glass of wine. I feel like the 13 Clocks, which is our book off the reading list that we're covering in this podcast,
yes.
is a tale of kings and dukes and princesses and knights errant and all things kind of magical and mystical that live in castles. And so a goblet of wine of some sort is appropriate. Also, I'm drinking mine out of a cup instead of a goblet because in honor of the Galax's dad, who was a wizard that would cast spells on himself when he was, quote, in his cups.
I love that phrase.
Yes.
It's such an eloquent way
it's
to
time
say
for us
you're
to get
drunk
in our cups.
We are often in our cups.
I
and
can,
quite wordy in our cups.
I can rarely find my way yes. out of my cups.
Where is the exit? And I don't know, because it's church drunk, I think mine is not in a chalice.
Oh, yeah, no.
Like, it's a holy chalice with my precious hands. Nope, it's
no.
just a wine cup, much like our no. Lord and Savior often used in his daily life, making
cup.
Holy out of regular shit, like humans.
All
okay.
right. So we are approaching the end of our summer reading list. This is our second
yes.
to last book. It's The 13 Clocks by James Thurber. It is like 100 pages of goodness. Like,
yeah.
It is this wonderful, wordy, magical adventure.
I was going to say, if you didn't know that we were like word lovers
yes.
from last week's like ode to words about Tom Robbins and Jitterbug, you will know it this time because this thing is just a delight to read.
Yes.
Like if you didn't understand the words, it wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
They're beautiful words. They all come together beautifully.
I love the unexpectedness of some of the words and the characters where it's just like, what you are anticipating coming or what you would normally put in some sort of a description.
Yeah.
You know, like gets flipped on its head. Like in that
totally.
Little intro. Like those were the first two paragraphs of the book. And in describing not Diz, but the Duke, the evil Duke who lives in Coffin Castle.
Right.
He talks about like going and looking through in nests and lairs
yes.
in search of animals to maul. You know,
right.
like not being mauled by them, but you are the one doing the mauling.
And even though the description is so evil and horrific, you're almost delighted by the playfulness of the words.
Exactly.
There's this lovely like paradox between
yes.
those two things and their interplay.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be evil like the Duke, but sometimes I might feel that way, and I wouldn't even mind if that's how
yeah.
somebody wrote about it.
And if you're a regular listener, you may have picked up on the fact that there are a few things that we here at Church Drunk like more than things that are like evil or twisted or messed up, but that still make us smile.
Yeah.
It's the type of music that I like where someone is like singing about something awful, but it's like happy and bouncy. It's the type of books that I like where it's like, this is awful and entertaining.
I think there's some self-reflective portion of that to most be examined likely. Or not.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so we really enjoyed this fun, easy, easy in the short sense. It's still a book that anybody could read.
It's a fairy tale, but it's one that is, you know, you can pick it up and as an adult, you can read it in an afternoon and really just kind of get lost in it and find some new stuff that maybe you haven't heard before.
Well, and that kind of, like, I wasn't aware of this book as a child or anything.
Yeah, no,
actually, you read, Guess really studied up on this deep dive guide. Do you know when it was published? It's kind of older, but not like super old.
It's older book.
So I didn't know it as a kid. 1950.
Yeah.
So it's before our generation.
And some people put it on like a, you know, great novels of our time lists and things like that. Like there is definitely a following for this book. But it's not, because it's not, you know, like what you would consider to be a novel. You know, I mean, it's a book.
It's not like children's literature.
Right. You know,
it's a book for book lovers.
It is. It is a wordsmith book, much like we were talking about Tom Robbins last week, you know, kind of a classic wordsmith.
Yeah.
And James Thurber apparently worked on this style. This is one of my my Wikipedia finds.
One of your nuggets.
Yes. Worked on this style of writing where there's kind of an internal rhyme scheme to it, you know, and you kind of get into the flow of it. And I was telling you, like, you get to the point where you almost can anticipate a line.
That's pretty cool.
And he worked on it on a couple of other books, but this is considered to be like where it all sort of came to fruition. So,
well, and speaking of like finding it and this whole idea of reading it out loud, the reason I found it, because I didn't have been exposed to it earlier, was through another favorite author, Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
So a year or two ago, Neil Gaiman on like social media posted how much he loved this book and had written a foreword. And so I, in a most typical fashion, bought the book for both of us and then never read it.
Yeah.
But I loved that I had it.
I will read it.
And Guess has buzzed through it several times.
Yeah.
But Neil Gaiman loves it for the same reasons we're kind of describing, like the words of it. And he says you have to read it out. Like, it's a book that you want to read out loud.
It's a very playful book, you know, despite the fact that there are some very sinister things. And there's also some very sort of philosophical, metaphysical things going on that you can play around with if you have a mind for it. It's also a book that you could read to your kids at night, you know, like if they're not going to be too scared by it because there is some creepiness going on.
Life is creepy.
A lot of people being run through
with a sword.
With a sword and fed to the geese.
And I like how he wipes his sword on like the beards of those he has run through.
Yeah,
like
totally.
The Duke is not even going to like clean your blood on his garments. He's going to run you through and wipe his sword on your face.
No man that wears velvet gloves all the time is going to wipe a bloody sword on anything of his own. So.
True. I mean, the gloves, that's kind of, have like jewels and stuff on them. These gloves are intense.
So let's set the stage here. The book, it moves. So I was surprised this most recent time that I read it, may have been this afternoon. And so I read it in one sitting to get through it. And it's a book that you can totally do that with.
Mm-hmm.
But the first time I read it, I wanted to like savor it. So I read it chapter by chapter, like one chapter every day. And it felt like a much larger sort of epic story. Whereas when you read it in one sitting, it feels like like The Princess Bride or something along those lines.
But that's kind of appropriate to it, right?
Yeah.
Because it talks about like then and now being different.
Yes.
Like time is part of this book. I mean,
it
it's
is.
Called The 13 Clocks and time is stopped at a certain time for a certain reason.
Right.
That has to do with this cold that's come into the
Coffin Castle. So
the Duke is
named The Duke. And he lives in Coffin Castle with his niece, Rosalinda. Niece is not named Guess. And she is kind of, you know.
It's not Rosalinda.
Isn't it? Rosalinda.
Sarah Linda.
Sarah
Linda. Damn, Guess.
I read it just this afternoon. Sarah Linda. And she's described so rose-like.
Right, you can't even tell that if her lips are like a lip or a rose. I'm like, oh my gosh.
So they live in Coffin Castle, and Sarah Linda is everything warm, and the Duke is everything cold, and he keeps her sort of locked up in this castle. And anybody that comes to ask for the hand of the fair Sarah Linda is given an impossible task by this very, very evil Duke.
Like, bring a sliver of the moon, or,
yeah. And so the stage is set for our hero who rolls into town as a traveling minstrel to show up at the castle and to ask for the hand of Sarolinda and to be sent on an impossible task by the Duke.
But he kind of enters in a different way.
He does.
So most of the princes who roll up come as princes and present themselves as such because she's a princess. Like, yes. Those are the only people who can seek her hand.
I would like to, yeah.
But our prince, our main character prince, he shows up and decides to, like, be different and, like, pose as, like, rags and tags and messy and
he's
minstrel.
Our prince is on a gap year.
Yeah.
He's just
off wandering.
Enjoying the world and trying to be one of the people. Yeah. So he needs to figure out a way into the castle since he's not a prince.
Right.
And he does so by inventing a very insulting song about the Duke, which is a surefire
like him already.
Way to get an audience.
It's a good
with
time.
The Duke. And this all happens within like the first 20 pages. It's not like we're even really giving away that much.
No.
Like this, the stage.
Spoilers alert, you've been warned.
Is so set, you know, like so quickly for this story to happen.
There's a lot of like cavalierness to this though, too, because, you know, he like somebody dies.
Yeah.
Because of his song.
Totally.
So that he can get there and meet them. It's like we're always kind of playing with evil in this book.
For sure.
Even the good guys.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it.
So the prince, Zorn of Zorna.
Zorn of Zorna!
Gets put in front of the Duke and pleads for his life and ends up being sent out on this task. But the person who's kind of whispering in his ear the whole time and helping him to pull some of the right strings to make this story keep going is... this wonderful character, the Gollicks.
And, like, is he even real? Like, we don't even know.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, the Gollicks kind of puts him up to it. Like, he doesn't even plead.
Yeah.
He has to, like, trick the Duke into, like, keeping him alive. So there's all this sort of scheming happening.
Yes.
And the Gollicks is, like, just the word reminds me of Gollum. So we're like,
it does, yeah.
Or, like, of a Gollum. Like, not Lord of the Rings Gollum, but, like.
Right, a Gollum.
An undead thing, yes.
Yes, the mythical character, the Gollum. And, yeah, so this Gollicks character wears an indescribable hat and pops up, and he's very sort of like, I don't know, flighty is not the right word. He can just sort of appear and disappear, and he pops up in all the right places at all the right times for the prince.
And his nature itself is fluid. He cannot be tied down, and he tries to, like, the only way you could explain mystery is by all these juxtaposed pieces. And so
he is a bit of an enigma, and he says things like, you know, all the places that I've been, I've never even heard of or whatever, but I don't know exactly what they are. Dizzy can tell you much better than I can because her favorite passage from the book is when the Gollicks first kind of shows up on the scene and starts to explain things.
So this is, there's like quite a long bit where he's trying to communicate to Prince Zorn of Zorna, like who he is. But there's one particular little excerpt that I will read to you now because this book is meant to be read and we did a whole summer reading list and have barely read to you, dear listener.
We try not to be too quotey.
All right. But this, we take an exception.
This one's worth it,
yeah. So the Gollum says, I make mistakes. He's not the Gollum, sorry. The Gollick says.
The Gollick.
I make mistakes, but I am on the side of good.
Yeah.
By accident and happenchance, I had high hopes of being evil when I was 2, but in my youth I came upon a firefly burning in a spider's web. I saved the victim's life. The fireflies, said the minstrel. The spiders. The blinking arsonist had set the web on fire. And this is just so perfect. Like that phrase, that little passage alone, like let us ponder the mystery here.
Yep.
And I just love it because it's funny.
Yep.
And it just gets you right at the end. And like, let's think about this. Like, yeah, if you're like a firefly, like burning up a spider's web, but the spider wants to eat you, who is the victim? Who is the right? Who is the good? Who is the evil?
Right. Exactly.
Summing up all of life and nature.
It takes your normal expectations and flips them upside down and has, it just has fun with kind of what you anticipate in the book.
Yeah, yeah. And like keeps it light at the same time.
Yeah.
And I do love that part about like, I want to be good, and I make mistakes.
Yes.
So we'll circle back around to this idea later for our church drunkenness part. But
totally. Well, and the other thing about the Gollicks is that he's forgetful. So comes up with these plans, and then he won't tell the whole plan. And then later on, it's like, hey, what was your plan? And he's like, wait, what? I had a plan, you know? But then he'll think of something on the spot that will sort of magically work itself out, you know? And so, and the question then is like, wait. Did he have that all along? Or, like, who is this character? And that's all that you're left with this Gollicks, is, like, really, who is this guy?
And he admits it, that he forgets things, or that he kind of convinces himself sometimes. Yeah. I feel like we all have, like, met that person who's, like, way older than us and, like, says things. You're like, is that a joke?
Yeah.
Like, did you know that was going to happen? Like, right. Is that for real? Like, the Gollux is like that times 100.
Yes. And somewhere in the very beginning of meeting the Gollux, he says something about, you know, like, I'm a Gollux. And the prince is like, what's that? And he's like, well, it certainly isn't just a device, like capital D device, yes, right? And
so it's good. Just like, so good.
This is, you know, it's a little, there's a little bit of Deadpool in of like breaking the fourth wall, you know, and it's just kind of like calling it out exactly what it is. Like, this guy is here to create chaos and to be wisdom and to, like, he is the ultimate literary device. You just get to play with him.
Totally.
Yeah. And he has an indescribable hat. And here's another little nugget that I found out. James Thurber, when he was writing some of his previous books, also illustrated them. And one of the things that we do love about The 13 Clocks is how beautifully illustrated it is. But by the time he wrote this one, he was blind.
Right.
And he could not illustrate The 13 Clocks.
That's very sad.
So the person that he got to illustrate it, whose name escapes me at the moment, was put to the test. And had to describe all of his illustrations. Mark Simont, thank you.
You're welcome, Diz. We're citing everything today.
So he was trying to, so he reads the description of the Gollux, and you have an indescribable hat.
Yeah.
And then his job was to draw it and try to describe the hat to James Thurber, and he would not be satisfied with the illustration of the Gollux until the guy could not describe his own version of
that
the hat.
Is fascinating,
right?
Like, so meta as well. Like,
so blind James Thurber is sitting there being like, nope. I can kind of visualize what you're talking about until
no
there was
that
no
is.
Description that would fit it. Yep.
So read the book just to imagine the book, a hat.
Look at the at the illustrations. Yeah. So our hero goes off on this quest. He's tasked with finding 1,000 gems, and in 9 and 90 hours. Hoping for 9 and 90 days, which would have been enough time to get to Zorn and have his dad give him, the king, all of the jewels.
Yeah, because he's
jewels.
Actually a prince.
Right.
Right.
So he's given less time, and that sets them out to go find Haga, who cries jewels. And so there's this moment where they have to try to make this person cry in order to accomplish their task.
Once again, moral quandaries here.
But they've met all these people that say Haga has no more tears, which I feel like is a phrase that describes my life. There are certainly days where I find myself just being like, oh, Haga has no tears anymore.
I am like Haga. All cried out. I mean, if your tears were actual jewels, like, I would make you cry.
Right.
I would try.
And then they have to come back to the castle. And the real task at hand, right, even if they're able to get these jewels and bring them back, was to restart the clocks. So they were, you know, that's the real, like, knowing, because the Duke has an idea that maybe this Zorn of Zorna is the prince and all this kind of stuff. So he goes, maybe the jewels will come through, but you've also got to basically restart time in the castle if you want to marry this fair princess.
And the time in the castle thing, like, okay, the Duke, who is not actually Dizzy, the actual Duke, is like a really bad guy, and he does mean things, but, like, the Duke is wounded, guys. Like, he's hurt.
You're sympathizing with the Duke?
No, because when he, like, there's a moment when the Duke, like, describes wanting to set the clocks right and also not wanting them to that is so human and so relatable. Like, it's the thing that you don't want to deal with, and maybe you should, but that's scary.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. There's a little sadness there.
Yeah, I suppose.
But he knows he has to,
but
right?
But he's so thoroughly evil, like, through and through.
Yeah, but he, like, loves her warm hands. That's not creepy.
Yeah.
Totally creepy.
A little bit creepy, yeah. I mean, he is. He does. She's the only warm thing in the castle, and he does have a heart for her. But he has no way of actually expressing it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she kind of seems chill with it all, to be honest.
Well, she may be under a spell.
Okay.
Maybe.
All right.
Spoiler alert.
No,
she doesn't. That's actually, if I were to quibble at all with the book, this fair Sarah Linda does not, she has a role as this, like, one warm thing in the castle.
Yeah.
but she's not given much personality.
Like, yeah, she's kind of really... the 50s princess. Yeah. I mean, it was published in 1950. I can, for sure. That would be a little quibble as well.
There's a lot of male, very powerful characters and power plays and stuff going on. But you have Haga, who needs to cry the jewels for everybody. And you have Sarah Linda, whose job is to be the warmth in the cold
and
she's castle.
Like, I wish him well.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Speaking from underneath her haze.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's this idea of time being frozen and then the Duke being cold either as a result of that or he was so cold that he froze the clocks.
I mean, the Duke was a bad guy.
But then he's claiming that he slayed time, like he killed time, and I think he's just taking credit where credit is not due.
I mean, he does like killing things.
Yeah. But how do you kill time?
I mean, you can't wipe its blood on its beard.
Jesus, I didn't even realize until right now that, like, killing time how is, like...
Time? Yeah, how do you kill time, everybody?
How do you kill
right,
time?
Gas, let him know!
God damn it. I didn't think about
Sorry,
that.
Sorry, clapping.
Like, see, slaying time is what I'm thinking, but, like, killing time.
He just
killing
sucked time. Into the story. And that is how we can all get sucked in.
He's just
so
sitting
deeply.
In Coffin Castle,
Thank
killing
you, James
time.
Thurber. And
man, I didn't even...
The sad
my
part
mind
is, I didn't either.
Exploding. Ugh, wow. So, we haven't even talked about the spies yet.
Okay.
The spy component where poor Whisper, right off the bat...
He gets actually killed. Slayed.
The Duke,
his time's over.
He gets slayed. So, the Duke employs all these spies, mm-hmm. and Whisper is the first one. We don't even really hear much from Whisper, because he has the unfortunate task of returning to the Duke with a bad report of what this minstrel has been up to, and he gets killed and fed to the geese.
Literally because Zorna Zorna said mittens, and
right.
the Duke does not want to discuss his gloves or mittens.
Having the mittens, yeah.
But, like, why did not Whisper lie? I mean, I understand he is also a capital D device, but...
Yes. Yeah, and that's
like,
it.
I feel like Whisper should have lied about the song and made up something else.
Probably.
Said kittens or something.
Right, well, but then that wouldn't enrage the Duke enough to actually bring in the minstrel.
Right, the device wouldn't work.
Who cares
the
about?
Story would not progress. I get that.
So Whisper is replaced... By Hark and Listen.
Hark!
And Listen is just in another sort of turn of perfectness. Listen is invisible, cannot be seen. And so Listen can only be listened to. And Hark, it wears a mask, and his job is to constantly be like badgering the Duke in the ear and be like, Hark, look at this. Hark, look at that. And it's just like every character is so perfectly itself. And you think of like a castle... Where Hark and Listen are working together, and Listen is invisible, and they're working on these little tasks, and nobody knows where Listen is. And suddenly the Duke is very dubious of Listen. Like, wait, I never know where my master spy is. Like, maybe I should think about this.
That means he's the most excellent of spies.
Yeah, this is perhaps true. And we haven't even talked about the Total yet. T-O-D-A-L.
The Total.
The Total, who is a blob of glurp, if I remember correctly, or a blob of glup.
I'll go with you.
And he is sent out to... the Duke lives in fear of only one thing, and it is the Total.
Right.
Because the Total is sent out by the devil take care of people who have not been evil enough. So if you're supposed to be evil, but you fail at being evil, the Total will come and steal you away. Like, the Total is the essence of nightmare because it's what evil people are afraid of.
Right.
Yeah. And so this is the Duke's one and only fear.
And does that make it, like, once again, full circle, does that make it, like, the friend of
right.
the good?
Exactly.
If you're not evil, do you have a cause to be afraid of the Total?
Right. So could
Things
you? Well, there's a theological argument there, right? Without good, there is no evil. Without evil, there is no good. People get into these like circular for millennia.
But like that's why we're supposed to, or not supposed to, but one reason we could love God, right? Like God is terrifying to evil,
right?
But we are not terrified of Him because we are not evil, except when we are.
Unless
like,
you practice the virtue of fear of the Lord.
I prefer wonder and awe.
Of course you do.
Church trunk.
So the book, I mean, okay. Leave it up to Church Drunk to take 100 pages of children's book and just go into like all of the character tropes and all that kind of stuff. We're not the only ones, though. We are not alone in doing that with the 13
It was
clocks.
Made for more than children. Yeah. Like, this is the Pixar of children's books. Yes. We're like, the adults also will enjoy it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a fun book. It's literally, I mean, we usually end these little discussions about books with like, who would enjoy this? And I can't think of many people that would not enjoy it.
Yeah. And I think even if you don't think you like words the way we do, you might. You might indeed. If you're exposed to them in this wonderful treatment. Yes.
I feel like The 13 Clocks is a good book to give you imagination. Even if you feel like you don't have a lot of imagination, The 13 Clocks will donate some to you.
Well, and once again, it is in very much keeping with our Church Drunk reading list this summer. We have a trickster. You know, we have mystery. We have time being played with. I think we inadvertently had quite a theme.
Turns out, yeah.
And we didn't talk about it last week, even though we meant to, with Jitterbug at the last words, and it is lighten up.
Lighten up.
I feel like that really is their little transition to this one, too. We're like, you know what? Everybody, there's a lot of bad things in the world.
Yeah.
In our politics, in our church, we are going to be talking about that.
For sure.
But also, maybe you just read a great fun read that
sit down for an afternoon
reminds you to lighten up
have
and
fun one.
Pretend you have an invisible Gollix with an indescribable hat who will help you through.
Pour yourself a glass of something blood red and read The 13 Clocks by James
Kill
Thurber.
Kill some time!
Oh, man!
Just do it.
So good.
Yep.
All right. Time to dig into our big
question box.
I think you're
huge.
Up. Well, that one jumped out.
One,
it just really
which one was it?
I don't know. I'm mixing it up so that you can grab
guess
one.
Guess is a no-cheating kind of guesser. It's
just
part of his name.
That one jumped out like
his device.
Overly ambitious carp.
Oh, my goodness. Never been a fisherwoman. Let's see.
So what's it say?
Okay. This is actually, I think, from me. Is there a facet of the face of the face?
A facet of the face?
I've had one glass of wine,
is
guys.
Is there a facet of the face that makes you facey?
Excuse me. Is there a facet? No. Is there a facet of the faith that is a gray area for you? Maybe for you, it should be, is there an area that's not?
I have many gray areas.
Something that you don't click with but don't object to.
Okay.
So that's what I meant when I was writing this. So
that's like, tougher because most of the things that I don't click with, I do object
honestly,
to.
Guys, we cling real hard to that whole personal conscience piece of the faith. But no, in this case, I was thinking, like, is there a practice or a devotion or just anything about the faith that it's something that it's just not your thing, but you don't really have an objection to it?
Yeah.
And so, like, why do people like that, maybe? Or why don't you like that?
You know, I think for me, one of the things that comes to mind is the devotion to a particular saint. Praying to the saints,
really?
Praying with the saints. I've always like kind of tripped up on my vocabulary there because like you don't pray to a saint, right?
Right.
And yet there are all these prayers that are kind of like quote unquote to Saint Anthony or Saint whoever, you know. And so it's like you are always praying with the saints. So you have to be very careful with how you phrase it.
I have thoughts on this too.
So
yeah.
I love the communion of saints. Mm-hmm. Like I'm totally on board with that. I love like those heroes of our faith. I think the idea that their lifetime can extend beyond just their time on earth because we really do believe that they are in heaven and that they can, you know, resonate throughout the ages. It's lovely. And it's how we pass stories down. But in terms of like having a devotion to a particular saint and praying constantly sort of to that saint or with that saint, that is something that I've never really done.
Dude, how do I not know this about you?
I know, yeah.
That's really interesting.
And it's funny, like, I've been to some holy sites, mm-hmm. you know, that revolve around saints. Like, I've been to Assisi, and St. Francis is certainly one of my favorite saints.
You've gone to a lot of places with the saints.
And I had, like, a beautiful spiritual moment in Assisi.
Yeah.
And I certainly would say that, like, by being there where this hero that I had grown up hearing about mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't walk away from it saying, well, now I'm going to pray to St. Francis or with St. Francis more. Like when I was on his turf, I really felt connected.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something where I'm going to walk away and be like, well, I'm going to pray the prayer of St. Francis. Because, well, I do love the prayer of St. Francis. Those are words that we attribute to St. Francis.
Sure.
But the prayers that are
spirit,
like, oh, blessed so-and-so of so-and-so, please do this thing for me, or with thy virgin hands, guide me ever, you know, like that's never been my brand of spirituality.
Wow. Like I did not know this about you. Yeah. And I think it's always fun to learn things that you think, you know, your friend, especially your religious friend.
I know, right?
In such a way.
Yeah.
But cause I don't feel like it's a good for me that I ask this question because, I like totally love the whole saints thing and I'm like very into it. And I think we often, because we sometimes deal with, like, teaching the faith, we say you don't pray to the saints because we don't want people to think they're worshiping the saints.
Right.
But I do think you address prayers to them. And the idea is, like, just the way we'd ask. The thing is, like, you can't talk to them in person. So, like, I can say something to you, right? And I'm not worshiping you. It's like saying something to them. Like, can you pray for me in this particular facet because they've been through something similar?
Yeah.
Okay. That's really cool. That's good to know.
I mean, I am fully on board with
the you don't object to it.
Love it.
It's
don't
just not your jam.
But in terms of incorporating it into my like day-to-day spirituality, I learn lessons from them. Like when I read about their lives and, you know, obviously we are of a Jesuit mentality. So like St. Ignatius of Loyola, like I enjoy like learning about his life, using some of the same prayer practices that he introduced. But it's not like I'm going
to
sit down every day.
You don't talk to him
now. Right. Yeah. I'm not going to sit down and like chat with the saints in my spiritual life.
I guess for me, it just feels a lot less lonely to know that there are like people who I would respect.
Yeah.
Who also like went through hard things and kept their spirituality and kept their faith.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like I just really like feel better to have them.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, so do I. And I love them. I love the idea of the communion being like that it bridges the gap from living to dead.
But like I like to know that like they're still there kind of though.
Yeah.
You know, like John the 23rd, like such a favorite of mine. And lately I've been saying a lot. I'm like, well, God, it's your church. Like that's his quote.
Yeah,
I'm like, you know, he's up there probably saying that too. So
All right. What about you? Any gray areas that you're kind of like
The ones I always think about are actually like the rote prayers, like the memorized prayers.
Yeah.
Because, and it's just sort of like a curmudgeonly thing for me where like I don't really like long spontaneous prayers that I'm forced to listen to of other people's.
Yes.
I partake in that in my privacy of my mind.
Yeah.
But I also like don't want to learn any new memorized prayers I did not learn as a child.
Yeah.
I feel like there's like this window when you're young and like you learn certain prayers by memorization. And now they are dear to me because those are the ones I know.
Yeah.
But if anybody tries to make me memorize some new prayer, even if it's old, I just don't want to.
I know.
I am not into it. I do not see the point.
Yeah.
I don't think the language is relevant. I do not think it's effective for me in prayer. And it is just a stubborn streak where I'm like, nope, like I am not learning that chaplet or that novena or that anything. Like I'm sorry. And it's, I have no objection to you learning it and praying it or anyone. And I'm sure it's lovely, but it's just not me.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And there, like, there is something that, for whatever reason, was ingrained into us from an early stage where you are allowed to just have a personal relationship with God in prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
and if you're angry, you can be angry.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're happy, you can be happy. And that's our particular sort of brand of spirituality more often than not. There have been phases of my life where I'm like, I need more discipline than that. You know, like I get lazy with that sometimes. And so that's what I'll turn to those like practice prayers where I'll be like, you know what? It won't kill me to do a novena. And then I do it. And I'm like, it also didn't really help me that much.
Yeah. I feel like those, like they're like chain letters. You know, like they set you up for like such a great payoff. And you're like, I don't know, like every novena I've ever heard about is because, like, you're going to get something amazing at the end.
Well, and that's, a lot of times, like, the
like
novena
a chain letter.
Is not,
that's not how prayer
and,
works.
And it's not necessarily for yourself. A lot of times the novena is for someone else or another group of people or some external thing.
That I understand more.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
But you know the ones I'm talking about where it's like, and your, like, magical wish will be answered.
Right, yeah, no. Yeah, I mean, and that's when you pray for others, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's an informal prayer or a very formal prayer, what you're saying, in essence, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
is like, I can't physically help, right?
Yeah.
Like the classic one was like, was it Lourdes or Fatima where we had to pray for the conversion of like Russia or some shit like that, that Mary told everybody, like, pray for the conversion of
Mary allegedly
these communist heathens, right?
I feel and it's like it has to be Fatima.
Like no one is going, I mean, I guess you could go on a mission to like these communist territories and do that kind of stuff, But, like, realistically, what you're saying is, I, as one person, cannot fix this, but what I can do is pray, right? So it helps you feel like there's something you're contributing to it. And yet, put yourself in the shoes of an atheist, and there's nothing more ridiculous than praying for God to, like, reach down and change the world in some way, right? And so you are doing the equivalent of nothing, you know? And so there's a back and forth in my brain of that, you know?
And I mean, I don't believe that. Like, I do think there is power in prayer, and there's something
but
there.
But it's hard to put your finger on what it is.
It's never the magic wand waving and poof, the desired result. Yeah. Like, that's just
there's
a fairy tale.
Too many people who want too fervently for, you know, grandpa's cancer to be taken away or whatever, you know?
And which is not it's wrong not, of them. It's just
it's just not always going to be answered, you know?
Yeah, and, like, I think that's the heart of it, too. It represents, like, a certain level of your faith life that we kind of hope adults, through life experiences and wisdom, move beyond.
And if you're asking for something miraculous to happen, there's, you know, there's no harm in asking. There's never any harm in asking. But if your faith is shaky enough that if that prayer is not answered in the exact way that you would want it to be answered, then you gotta go back and reevaluate, you know?
Yeah. So, all right. Well, those are some things that, if you like those things, you could tell us why, but.
Totally. And
I do like the Saints.
It's a good way of throwing it out there and saying, you know, like, something that you can tolerate, right? Because we talk a lot about what we will not tolerate.
Yes. That's a long list, too.
And we'll get to that probably during our Advent season. But, you know, something that's like, okay, like, if that's your jam, great. And it's not doing any harm, but, you know, not necessarily resonating with us.
Curious, like, why people like something in a certain way that I just don't get. And I think it was good to actually have one the opposite direction where I'm like, no, I totally love that.
Right.
Like, why don't you like that? And that's just, you know, to kind of be on our there are good things in the Catholic faith soapbox. There's a million traditions and cultures and representations. So.
For sure. And that's part of what makes us still Catholic is the fact that there's room, in the church for a lot of stuff.
On that list also is you don't have to believe in any Marian apparitions. Actual teaching.
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't have to.
You don't have to. No, the church doesn't like officially endorse them. They're just like, sure, that could have happened.
Yeah.
But like they're never teaching.
Right. It's not that. Anywho.
Okay. Well, you can tell us what you do or don't believe in what's on any of your lists, especially what you like and don't like.
Yeah.
By emailing us.
Email us, churchdrunk@gmail.com.
You can tweet at guests at churchdrunkpod.
At churchdrunkpod.
And check out the website.
Churchdrunk.com.
And we have just one more book.
One more book next week.
To bring out our summer. And this is our only nonfiction.
Yes. So we're stepping out of our comfort zone of nonfiction.
Into a slightly different comfort zone.
Into a very slightly different comfort zone of like church nerdy books.
There is no, you know, Greek gods though. There are no time travelers per se.
Per se. Yeah. I mean, it opens up the door to time travel.
Right.
You know. But the book is called God's Mechanics, and it's by Brother Guy Consolmagno, who is the director of the Vatican Observatory. So he's a nerd. He's a scientist. Yeah. He's a Jesuit monk.
He's a brother.
Yeah.
He pretty much wraps up most of the things I love in life.
He does all of these awesome things. So God's Mechanics will be next week, and that will be the end of our Church Drunk Summer reading list, which seems appropriate because summer is drawing to a close.
Sadly over. I am, you know, crying tears like Haga, jewels dropping into the desiccated end of summer.
Haga, which we also found out, a little nugget, means shit in Hindi.
So gross.
I don't think that's what James Thurber had in mind when he wrote about it.
Hard pass, James Thurber.
Anywho, we'll see you next time here on Church Drunk, where we're searching for the Gaeliks in all of us every single week.
What's your hat?
Cheers.